Don't have to sell anything. As a matter of fact, if we had simply been witnesses in service, the witness, that if there had been some integrity to it, might indeed have communicated. There has been very little to communicate, hasn't there? Yes, sir. I think it's a very natural, meaningful thing for a group of people. And as long as it is not regarded with the slightest shred of self-righteousness by anybody, so that no one would ever claim that anyone was a super or plus Christian because of it, or that it was required at all, as over a baptism, I think it's fine. I think that the danger of an elitism when somebody comes along and says that you aren't really Christian until you do such and such, then is terribly sad. But I think it's a bit like the Casilla movement in the Catholic Church, which a lot of people criticized because they were afraid of it. I made my Casilla in Nazareth. I was invited by Catholic priests and laymen, and we went to Nazareth. And we went to Israel and Jerusalem and all, and they were nice people. Five priests and about 40 laymen. And it's amazing in Nazareth, you kind of realize that there was a boy by the name of Jesus who was looking at some of the same things you're looking at. Went to Galilee, stood in the places, read the relevant scripture. It's a very meaningful thing. But the Casilla was a very intense 3 or 4 day period of kind of rededication. And more conservative Catholics tend to feel it's simply emotional and so forth. And I'm sure it's misused in many cases. But the point is, for a great many people, very, very meaningful. And I think that the speaking in tongues is for many people much the same thing. No, I haven't. It's always seemed like, I would hope it wouldn't gain in numbers as such, because I think the value would, I mean, then it tends to institutionalize itself and get written up in Time magazine and so forth, and then it's in trouble. Then you better find something else to do. I hope Time magazine doesn't write any of us up next week. Wouldn't it be a riot if there was a two-part religion story? A seminary split asunder or something, part one, and then idiot Episcopal priest does something, part two, and... Yes? I don't think too much of the Jesus Freak movement. I sympathize. I think there's some beauty in it. When you examine it, the extreme self-righteousness of it, the terribly simplistic quality of it, the kind of magic part of it, the crutch part of it, which is, of course, those are the worst parts of your Casilla when you're speaking in tongues. The faddish part of it is difficult. You know, like I was talking to a student here at the Washington University, and he said that he says his older brothers and sisters are into drugs, but the younger ones don't do drugs because they use Christ instead. Well, I hope there's something valuable in it, but I'm not going to be taking it quite that seriously, you know. Reminds me a little of the people who gave up gin for Lent, I remember, and then they said, we lost so much weight and it went so well, we're going to give it up for another 2 weeks because, you know, Christ can be terribly helpful, as good as Vic Tanny, and it's cheaper. Yes.
Is and will be manifest partly in
the judgment of God is being manifested corporately in America. I've never looked for kind of the moment of fire. I see the absence of laughter, the absence of joy, the almost total absence of community in a people who don't even have privacy in the bathroom. And I see the judgment constantly now. And I don't think it's a judgment by an angry God. I think it is rather what the nature of God permits due to the free will of people who chose to destroy so much of their own life and the lives of other people, and with people like Billy Graham around, to do it in the name of God and even Jesus Christ. I thought the July 4th thing of Dr. Graham's was, Billy Graham, was an absolute abomination. And I have come to feel he's dangerous, and I oppose him, and I didn't used to. I used to feel that he was probably sincere and surrounded by vulgar press agents. But I think now that he's a self-serving man, a Caesaro papist, it came to me when I was arrested across from the White House with Rosemary Ruther and Dr. Spock and a lot of people. And we were having a completely nonviolent, very quiet, a prayer service for peace across from the White House the morning, I believe, of Kent State. And we're arrested and we're thrown into this paddy wagon caked in blood. And then I remember that he can preach in the East Room and not be arrested. What's he saying? And the July 4th thing, the linking, it's an Agnew-like thing. It's almost saying that to have a critical view of the American way of life has a treasonous tinge to it, and that God is somehow linked to America or to what we call democracy more than to what we call communism. As if one could judge in many of those cases which is indeed more democratic, because communism is not a monolith. Communism in Albania, Czechoslovakia, Russia, China, and so forth, it is a meaningless term. To call someone a communist now in this country is almost a funny term, because it can mean a very silly, stiff-necked, rigid person completely out of touch. It doesn't mean a revolutionary anymore. It means somebody quite passé, usually, who doesn't know anything, hasn't any links with anybody. But I see this judgment everywhere. And I would say that July 4th thing, I did look at it on television. I didn't want to, and it was painful. But here with Graham and an entourage and the prestige of the media, Kate Smith, Bob Hope, whose favorite joke, according to the New York Times Magazine, was what Robert Kennedy is supposedly to have said as he lay dying on the floor of the Ambassador Hotel. These are our great people. This is the judgment of God. The filth that can call great people in this country. Yes. Well, as a priest, in other words, one is not a priest in the Episcopal Church unless he is in a diocese under a bishop who heads the diocese. And I'm in the Diocese of New York, and my bishop is Paul Moore Jr., who's a close friend. And it is a relationship to kind of a brother in Jesus rather than a father in God, which I would find untenable now. So it is a painful, struggling real relationship, because he's looking too, sort of desperately sincere, I think. More and more people are where I am, and it's no fun, but it's a fact. In other words, we're not in parishes. There isn't a kind of definable, localized Christian community. We receive no income from the church. And a lot of us are just this way, like Karita is this way, and a whole lot of people in different denominations. And I look upon it as a very hard thing that I accept now. In other words, I've never thought that the absence of tension was normative for the Christian life. Bart said there's a sinking and a suffering, a being lost and a being rent asunder in the peace of God. I accept that. And so this is not a time of enormous joy for anyone. And I love many of the things of the church that I can't have now. I mean, I love vestments and chapels and services and music, many aesthetic things, but I can't have them. I also love understanding and community and solidarity in the absence of controversy. But that's over now. I'll never have that again. And I'm not happy about that. Well, I don't think anything's viable for everybody. And see, what we were taught was it was viable only to have constituencies. When I was in seminary, it was unthinkable that one would have anything but a parish church. The idea of a worker priest was completely out of the question. You could have a hospital or military chaplaincy, but it was frowned upon until you had served in a parish church. So, and see, the question of constituencies simply is now, a great many people, I think, aren't saying they won't localize themselves, but they're saying that they cannot conform the proclamation of the gospel, and I didn't say preaching because the proclamation takes a number of forms, they cannot conform the proclamation of the gospel to the wishes of the constituency. But I mean, I could tell you dozens or hundreds of churches, would you need me to? Don't you know? Where the gospel, its proclamation has been utterly conformable to the wishes of the constituency? Don't you know that? You must. It's just that you're not quite as old as I, but you must know that. Because I do know that. I was in one Episcopal diocese several years ago, and there were three schools, church schools, which I think are very bad. I don't believe in church schools. And no one black was there, no students, no teachers, nothing. And the headmistress of the white girls' school told me, she says, I tried. She says, I told the girls to put their heads down, to hide their eyes. And then she said, would those of you who would have any objection to Negro schoolmates raise your right hand? And then she said, there is one other question. Would those of you who would object to having a Negro roommate raise your right hand? And then she said to me, the girls did not want it. Then I asked the head of the boys' school, and he says, we can't do that because it would lead to intermarriage. And one of the most distinguished black scholars and intellectuals in the country, who happened also to be an Episcopal priest, spoke at a leading university near there and was not invited to the Episcopal school because they wanted the image of black men to be only janitors cleaning urinals and toilet basins and shuffling and saying yaza, but it would demolish the myth of this to have a proud, disciplined, scholarly, intellectual black man come in as a human being and address them and teach them something. And then I talked to the head of the Episcopal school for the younger ones, and He said, the bishop said to integrate, and I said, Bishop, if we integrate, we go broke and we close. And he says, the bishop never mentioned that again. There's your constituency. At its worst, except it's all over. Even recently, I assisted Henry Stein, a black priest in Washington, D.C., in a black church. When Henry, who's a, if Henry were not a nigger, he'd be a bishop. My friend Chester Higgins, who's on Jet Magazine, if he were a black journalist, he'd be in the New York Times, the Chicago, sometimes the Chicago Tribune. He's with Johnson Publications, which is okay. The point is Chester could never be with anything ever, and he's been now in the ghetto of black publications. Now they would all look for some chic token black. Yes, I don't think he wants it. Henry Steins, when he came to Washington, D.C., was offered two churches, both black. And this is the diocese that would claim to be liberal and radical and to care. In our church, our black church, one Sunday afternoon, we invited the high school youths of the whole diocese to come, and we were going to sing and things, and I was talking. We waited, the black youth and I. And finally, about an hour late, four whites came. I mean, they were expecting around 300. And in one case, a parent had forcibly stopped the bus from leaving with the children. They felt that this kind of contact would lead to intermarriage, to relationship. Can you imagine what it did to the black children, the black high school students? Where is the love of Christ in the felt by those black high school students that afternoon who had invited their Christian Episcopal brothers and sisters to come for 1 hour and who waited in vain? Are they going to wait again? This reminds me of Cry the Beloved Country, Alan Payton, who said it was Emmis Mongo who said, wouldn't it be tragic if they had turned to hating, if we had turned to hating by the time they had turned to loving? What do you think it meant to the black parents who are proud? They're Episcopal. This is their own church. How was the afternoon with Malcolm Boyd and with all those kids who were coming? How was the music? What happened this afternoon? This was after Martin Luther King. This was after marches. These opportunities are not given anymore. And now I find white people who are hurt. When I was at Yale, a couple of white youths were out walking one night when I was, and they came up and they said that we don't want to live in South Africa. We don't want to live where the blacks won't speak to us and eat with us and spend time with us. What could the churches have done? Any black Episcopal priest will tell you that the one committee he could be on was CSR, Christian Social Relations. But see, nobody black wants to be on Christian Social Relations anymore. And as Earl Neal, one of the best black priests I ever knew, who's in Oakland, and he's very close to the Panther movement there, he recently said, I think everyone black who has anything to do with a white denomination will probably leave it. And Catholic priests in Chicago have said the same recently. Many people speak of splits in the church. Many people feel that some people who feel one way, who are Missouri Synod and other Synod and Episcopal and Baptist and Lutheran and Presbyterian and all the rest of it, may be simply ecumenically coming together as over against other people. I don't know. Did you have something?
Yes, I want to ask you this. Would you accept that you are being trained basically
Well, I don't know precisely what you're doing here, but I mean, I do know fairly well, and I would say that the teaching, unfortunately, is anachronistic in too many cases. This is unfortunate. I don't know, and I'm sorry, I do not mean to be rude by this at all, but I do not understand the self-perpetuation of seminary faculties, and I don't know why people on the faculties aren't forced out into parish work every few years to get anywhere off of this holy hill into life. Go to work as a chaplain of an advertising agency. Do anything. And I don't know why somebody else doesn't come in here and teach occasionally. I do not understand this total polarization that you get into. And I think there's a great trouble here. And of course, far more problem than the faculty is the administration, which is very rigidly controlled by all the denominations involved. In the Episcopal Church, it has to do with who gets honorary degrees, which is, means nothing. It's a sort of whore thing given to people who raised money and were elected to church positions. It has nothing to do with intellectual competence. In fact, it should be stopped immediately. It's a very very anti-intellectual thing, the awarding of honorary degrees. And it makes you not be able to take seriously the academic qualifications of seminaries when they act anti-intellectually. But you can't just blame people. If you have faculties who are totally unrelated and who have been here too long without a change, you get into a self-perpetuation thing, particularly if over them are the claims, the rigid claims of hierarchy. So, I mean, the end result is that students have a lot of anachronistic teaching. In my own case, which isn't exactly current, but I don't think it was that long ago, the courses on Christian education were just absolutely incredible. They had nothing to do with it when you would, they really didn't. Homiletics really had nothing very much, as I recall, to do with. Church history, ours was entirely Anglican, so it was really as stupid as studying American history from some white who doesn't understand American history, he just understands white American history. So we got Anglican church history. I got liturgics. Do you realize no one told me how to say the Mass? And I got to Oxford University, and I really didn't know how to get the robes on and go into an altar after all those liturgic courses. So some very nice priests there worked with me, and every morning I'd get into the full thing and come in and practice this the saying of the service, which I wanted to be absolutely perfect and devoid of my own personality so that only God said it. The ministry that you're being sent out to, I'm not just going to say that it's anachronistic, let's just say that it is rapidly changing. You see, when men are unprepared, as many of you will be, you then latch on to gimmickry like Esalen and madness, ridiculous things. You touch bodies, do anything. Because you're desperate, you're not getting anywhere. And you've had no experience, you're empty, arid, dreadful little people inside, and you say, I want to experience something, so maybe Esalen will do it. And if I'm nude in a bathtub with somebody, well, it just doesn't do it exactly. Maybe you get an erection or something, but I don't think it does a great deal more than that. So, I mean, you are subject to gimmicks and demons because you have no substance, in my opinion. I really think this is very good. I look at these fads sweep by, and it's, am I supposed to take them seriously? No, thank you. A friend of mine, a school teacher in White Plains, very sensitive woman. I grew up with her, and she's been divorced, and she says, I'm going away to a laboratory. And I said, oh, honey, be careful. Don't be destroyed. She made it. She came by and she came back and she says, I have made one black friend. And I said, Barbara, good for you. I've shared the black experience. I was with a young Lutheran minister in Buffalo recently. Sort of a saint, harassed, driven. I think his wife had just left him. I don't know what was going on. This place smelled. Kind of a beautiful person in a lot of ways. Very sensitive and caring. Obviously not in an institutional mold at the moment. I don't know what you're going to do. You're going to go out in a world in which your own church is one of the leading instruments of racism and one of the major institutions of its institutionalism in the society. An enormous concentration of power and money that represents white power. And I don't know what you can do about that. And it isn't as simple as writing a check. Not that you're going to do that anyway, the money won't be there to write it, but I mean, it wouldn't be that simple. And the war will be going on in one form or another because we are simply militaristic, and you have to use cliches, I guess, colonialist, imperialist. It's our nature now. We're Rome. And I don't know what you do with Caesar when you are Christian in Rome. Render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's? No, thank you, Dr. Billy Graham, for your simplistic blasphemy. I don't know what you're going to do about it, or how specifically you can do it. And if you're in a poor area, or a middle-class one or something, that's going to affect you in relationship with people, and the question of poverty, and are you still going to think that, you know, there can be spiritual revival with these enormous meetings and these big-time gimmicky publicity things? Or are you going to realize that this is something that has to happen in individual lives very quietly? In other words, you're becoming this. You're going to be ordained. And there's a hymn about it, the mantle of the prophets. And then, of course, what only I or someone like me can tell you, because you don't know yet, you're going to be reverend unto hell. It is just incredible what that means. Pardon me, reverend. Excuse me, Father. I didn't mean that. I forgot you were here. I forgot this irrelevant little person was here. I'm sorry. I did an article for The Critic for March on, is the priesthood obsolete? Which is not a Catholic question. Of course it's not obsolete, but it's quite obsolete institutionally. Meaning, you cannot shut the priesthood up, or the ministry, whatever you want to call it, in these vessels and categories. It's a free thing. It occurred to me when I was in a jail cell in Washington not too long ago, and we had the bread and the wine, and we were going to have the communion in the Pentagon. This was another time. And we were arrested immediately. And somebody in the cell said, "Here, Father, would you give us communion? Will you consecrate the element?" And you sort of wonder, what magic did they think you were going to conjure up? And what, could they not have had communion without the minister? This had a marvelous ending. It wasn't wine, it was sparkling burgundy, I guess. And none of us was aware of this, but as this high school kid who was in jail with us helped me open the bottle, it popped, and this red flow hit the white cell wall, and of course the pop sounded like a gun going off, and this was blood, and the cops rushed in, and they've heard the gun, and they've seen the blood, and the bottle was seized. It was a great moment. I know your question. It's the most real one, and the answer is it's going to be so much up to you, because you're not going to be able to look to seminary professors or bishops or anybody, are you? My first parish, when I got there, that I'll never forget the first night, because there was that one bed and the phone that you had to... there was no chair. The roof leaked, and that's fun. That's the fun part of it. The unfun part was I was a very arrogant young clergyman, and I mean, one had to be organized. I had learned that in seminary. I said, who are my offices? Would you stand and give your name and tell me your position, please? Who is the head of my man? Who is my senior warden? Who is my junior warden? Would the head of the women stand? Nobody. Isn't there a head of the women? Silence. There were two heads of the women. Schism. It had come about through a church bazaar. So I went to the bishop and said, what do I do now? And he said, you will have to dissolve both organizations, form the temporary Guild of St. Mary, which you will head, until such time as you have disciplined the women. So I called this one woman. She became a Rosicrucian shortly thereafter. And of course, that means you've lost $5 a week on the pledge. She was a big giver. That's a big problem in your first church with the furnace to keep going in the winter. Those are your problems, not the Pope and Vatican II and the war, man. That one time the furnace wasn't going to operate, and I said to this Florence Christoph, who was rather elderly, and I said, Florence, well, she says, I'm not coming to church without the heat. And I said, well, Florence, in the catacombs they didn't have heat, and they were Christians. And I said, we can't help it. And I said, wear your gloves and just take them off when you receive the body of Christ. Other than that, keep your gloves on, keep your coat on, keep your hat on, wear a muffler. She says, I'm going to the Methodist church, and when you get the heat on again, I'll come back. I'm not going to do this. You couldn't lose the Christoph. Those are your real problems. Have you read Diary of a Country Priest? Don't you read that? I consider that very important, the Bernanos book. I really do. The first line is so wonderful. It says, in effect, all parishes are the same as mine. Which is okay. It's a microcosm. But you'll be there. I spoke in one church. They'd really just crucified this guy who was a friend of mine. He was left in a nervous breakdown. And I said in my sermon to them, I said, it seems to me that you don't drink either homogenized milk or gin. You drink the blood of clergymen. They lost three rather quickly. It's an interesting thing to be doing right now. Very complicated. Yes.
I agree with you on Bernanos. Another step before I tell him not to love anyone. I'm not so sure I agree with you on something you said earlier. When you asked me about that missionary and the news that I went down the stream. A false baptizer and not listening to the people and so on. I don't think that the matter of fact, I think
I was just rereading Somerset Maugham's Rain the other night, which is such a good story. It's part of the truth. And the point is, it wasn't the missionaries who were alone responsible for a mission point of view. We all shared it, and I think still do. The point I was really trying to make was, I think it's terribly unfortunate that we don't know very much about Eastern religions, and yet we've been involved institutionally in the East for a long time because, frankly, the cross has followed the flag and the dollar. It's been a part of the process. I don't like the military chaplaincy story at all. And it always looks good to me when I read official stories about it, but when I talk to the men, I just did some reporting on Vietnam War veterans in a book I wrote. And talking to the men, their description of the chaplaincy was just, they felt this was an official institutional person who was supposed to cheer them up and get them going and so forth, whom they really could not sort of existentially trust. And to me, that's the extension of the mission idea. It does seem odd to me that we don't know more. I think we ought to. I think it would be a sign of our Christianity if we did. And I know in seminary we really did not adequately learn other religions. There was a kind of odd course. I always shied away from the comparative religion kind of course because it was offered, I felt, as a kind of smorgasbord. And not usually awfully well done, in secular institutions, I mean, and we didn't even have it very well. But it's something I think a lot... See, I think one of the problems today is a lot of students are kind of interested in the occult or Eastern religions, looking in effect for an alternative. And their mistake, of course, is they are dealing with something at a distance that's quite interesting and intellectually could be extremely stimulating for a while, but of course they're right back into institutional religion in another genre. Which is so, and also it wouldn't be for most people. There is something about the fact that one... is culturally a part of a region, I think. Very much so. I think religion has much to do with geography. And so I think that it probably just should have been much more ingrained in people, an understanding of other religions, so that it wouldn't have to be kind of a compulsive thing now, or that they might not have hopes and anticipations for it that will not be met. I have a friend, a television producer in Los Angeles, who's a Buddhist now and has been wanting me to come to a meeting with him, and I saw on television something of a Buddhist meeting, and, well, in effect, there's nothing in terms of contemplation and prayer and mysticism and spiritual experience that he could not have in the Christian experience. And I would remove the esoteric, curious aspects from it. And I also think that maybe faithfulness Christianly means we really ought to know and respect, I think, how other people approach God, and I don't think we do. And I think maybe this is why we call Vietnamese geeks and so forth. I mean, we really do not respect these people. We feel, I think we have terribly felt that we had a, I don't want to say pipeline to God, that's another cliche that's boring, but I mean, I think that we have felt a certain exclusivity, that we were particularly blessed. And I don't think, not only weren't we particularly blessed, but I think like in our treatment of the Native American and the real genocide that took place there, it's something we haven't looked at yet. One of my worst moments was on an Indian reservation where I visited, and well, they did have this Anglo-Saxon blonde, blue-eyed Jesus on the wall. And I had to insist that they take it down. These are people of no pride. The jails were full of people who had tried to leave. There was no identity. Really broken. They should have had a Native American Jesus on the wall. He wasn't Anglo-Saxon. Reminded me of being in Watts during the revolt in Los Angeles, and some white Presbyterians sent the same white picture of Jesus into the black people with the gun still firing. This was meant to be an act of love. You know, I mean, bread and milk would have had. But my worst moment on the reservation was when these elderly 60, 70, 80-year-old Indian men and women knelt and they said, would you please put your hands on their heads and bless them? That was terrible. I would much rather have received their forgiveness. No, I have no right to have received their forgiveness. I could have maybe asked for a sign of love. Who were they to kneel before me? My friend Bob Chapman is now at the National Council of Churches, a black priest, had a slight nervous breakdown in Chester, Pennsylvania, when he was jailed a long time ago, but that was his first experience, because in the communion in the cell, he was kneeling as a brother, white clergyman, administered communion, and I think for the first time, Bob heard black prisoners saying, why are you kneeling in front of that white man? Yes, please. Well, my income is, obviously I'm a writer, and it's largely from writing. I think that we're in a revolution that has to do with institutions right now. The family is under an enormous attack. Some people are choosing communes. A number of people are not being married and living together. There are a number of approaches in this area. A number of kids are very concerned about the question, as children in the nuclear family. And you're familiar with that, but the university has been going through a tremendous self-searching institutionally, and I think not nihilistically so much as a desire to find roots, to define what the original meaning was that seemed to have got lost. This is terribly true of enormous factory universities where there is no community of scholars at all. There's no relationship between anybody. I visited a friend at Michigan State the other day, a male student, and he was in a room with two others, and they were impersonal. There was a study room for 400, a snack bar for 2,000, a factory. He has to be in one line for breakfast, and it's only in a 15-minute period at that line, and so forth. And of course, faculty have been very conscious of this. The military, conventional politics, the church. And the people are very seriously asking questions from a number of different standpoints. Would it be a mixture of the old and the new? Does the old completely have to die, and in dying is there a resurrection? I mean, these are just, I think, the questions that I find being asked an awful lot. But you meant the military chaplain more than the college, I mean by chaplain? Yeah. I think it's very much the club. I think we deal with a gentleman's club kind of thing. I think when we move into areas where we are professors or we are whatever we are, there's obviously kinship and linking, mutual problems. Any professor understands the problems of tenure, the problems of completing a PhD, the problems of completing his dissertation. His instructor or assistant professor status, his desire for associate or full professorship status, the need to leave an institution, and whether he'll have more pay or less pay, but if he can also increase the title. Everyone, I think most faculty, go through this and are sympathetic with this because it is part of their own lives. So I think, therefore, groups have special interests because people are in groups, and they have interests. The interests have to do with survival and their position vis-a-vis other groups. There's a very strong faculty group vis-a-vis students. The interests are different. The faculty, quite rightly, feel that they are a continuing community. The students, with all of their ebullience, and passion are going to leave in a very short time. When, of course, they may, they do become part of the alumni, another group, but they may not be active. So that a military chaplain, obviously, if he's of any value at all to the thing, by becoming a military chaplain, espouses certain points of view, has some certain ideas about the kind of job he has to do and is able to do, would have to receive much the same kind of training. Then I think with individuals, of course, faculty, military chaplain, college chaplain, and so forth, you have the individual problems coming out of the individual personality problems of the individual, his drives, what he wants out of his life, that sort of thing. I wouldn't say I've been poo-pooing institutions. I think we're so encased in them. I think it's a moment in history when we are all concerned with liberation from those things encasing us. We're trying to breathe. We don't want to be... 1984 isn't that far off. I was reading the other night, Ionesco did a piece in which he foresaw a race of sheep. And I think most of us who have any, you know, awareness of television and technology and this kind of thing are very concerned about this. And the question is, how can we survive, or can we at all creatively in the middle of this? What can we do? How can we make institutions affirm our humanity rather than crush us and make us merely serve them? Because we've been through such a period in which machines were supposed to serve us, they aren't serving us at all. Our whole lives run around machines. And it took Kubrick in 2001, The Space Odyssey, to point out that wonderful human characteristic of the computer, of the, not the computer, was it? The, yeah. Well, we ought to stop, I gather.
I don't think I addressed myself to anything you wanted me to, but the point was I did ask the question, so consequently, if you'd wanted me to talk about, what are the questions?